Hey everyone, welcome back to the podcast. I'm Regina.
And I'm Char.
And this is Irresistible,
a podcast brought to you by Drexel University's Music Industry Program. All right, welcome back everyone to another episode. Today we have a really special guest, none other than Jeff Apruzzi, our music industry director of the program. So why don't you introduce yourself, Jeff?
Hello, everyone out there. My name is Jeff Apruzzi. I am, what's my title anymore? No, I'm assistant professor and program director of the music industry program at Drexel. And yeah, if we count the lost year that we've had with COVID, I guess this would be my third year at Drexel. And I'm excited to be here, not only to be on the podcast, but especially with the both of you, because you were in one of the first year that I was teaching at Drexel. You both were in my live music industry class. And so I feel like especially the current cohort of juniors really hold a special place in my heart.
We all grew up together.
Yeah.
Exactly.
We started
That's
at the
so
same
exciting.
Part.
Mm-hmm.
So we wanted to dive a little deeper into your career, go back until a young college man, and see.
That's a dark place.
Well, obviously your career did start because you were also in the music industry program at Berkeley. So why don't you talk about how that was for you and then how your career grew from there?
Yeah, so I mean, I would be kind of dismissed to like make it seem like I went seamlessly from being in high school to going to Berkeley, but I was a really bad student. In high school, all I really cared about was surfing and skateboarding and playing music, and never really thought about going to college, which probably isn't the best thing to hear from the person who's the director of a college program. And so after I graduated high school, I remember my parents are always saying to me, you're going to be really upset when all of your friends go away to college and you're still here. And I was like, no, you don't know what you're talking about. And they were totally right. So after I graduated from high school, this is kind of the longer, shortened version of my trajectory. I went to community college for a year. I played in a jazz band. I played upright bass because I really thought that jazz was the way forward. I got accepted into Berkeley. And probably not unlike a lot of students in their undergrad, I was really kind of overwhelmed and confused with what I wanted to study. And so originally I was studying performance, and then I was like, no, I want to be an engineer. And then I didn't get into the engineering program. And then I was like, I want to be a music therapist. And I was like, oh no, I don't want to do clinicals in a hospital, that freaks me out. And then I was like, well, I don't really need a piece of paper to tell me that I can play my instrument. And so I eventually changed my major to study music business at Berkeley. Kind of fast forward to the end of my time there, I took out a lot of loans to go to college, and I was in a lot of debt. And right when I was graduating, I remember my parents vividly telling me, you have 6 months to get a job. Otherwise, and once those 6 months pass, like, you need to start making payments on your loans. And I was like, oh my God, like, I haven't been looking for a job. Like, I've just been playing music and enjoying my time. And, I had done some internships with some independent labels and with an organization in Boston, the Boston Music Awards and things like that. And so, I was doing other things, but I was, the entire time, I think not dissimilar from a lot of students and programs, was like really just playing in a lot of bands. I was in so many bands that like would play one show, then we would break up, and then we'd be in another band and then play another show. blah, blah, blah. And you know, literally like right as I was getting ready to graduate, the band Passion Pit was starting. And it was, you know, four guys, you know, three people at Berkeley and then two people at Emerson. And they'd played one or two shows before. And right as we were graduating, the former bass player was going away to do like a Habitat for Humanity type of studies. And one of the guys, Ian, who's, you know, one of my best friends still, he was the best man at my wedding, was like, hey, would you want to like, you know, fill in, play some shows with us over the summer? We'll pay you like $50 a show. And I was like, hell yeah, $50. Like, that sounds awesome. And the second show I wound up playing with them wound up being a showcase for a record label called French Kiss out of New York, which is now part of the Orchard Group. And, you know, a lot of what I'm sure I said this in our classes that I had with you both as well, is like, and I'm sure you've all heard this, like the industry is so small and like the network is just, you know, it's the 6 degrees of Kevin Bacon. Like everyone knows someone to some extent. And when I was playing in the band for this record label showcase, I had actually interned for one of the guys at a different label. I'd interned for Paul Hanley when he was handling all the press for a smaller label called Kamado, who released released one of my favorite Swedish bands called Dunion. They also released some music from a Texas like heart heavy rock band called The Sword. So I would definitely check those bands out. But anyway, yeah, it was just one of those right place at the right time type of things. And you know, I think everyone always will, you know, as we've all known and discussed, right, there's no silver bullet for kind of achieving any sort of success. But, you know, a lot of times I think being in the right place at the right time is kind of hard work in disguise, right? Someone gave me that advice early on, is that like, everyone wants to say, well, luck got you there, right? But I think a lot of times the luck that got you there was also the hard work that you kind of put into it. And so when I look back and see kind of like, you know, as all the bands that I played with and the different opportunities that I was always trying to pursue, all that kind of coalesced into this, right? And so we played the showcase and, you know, more or less they were like, we don't know who this other guy who's supposed to be playing bass is, but you know, like you should be in the band. So the other thing was then convincing my parents, right? My parents are still like, hey, you need to pay off these loans, that's great, like you sign, you know, your band signing a record label for a few thousand bucks, like that's not really going to do much for you. And you know, that kind of all happened because that, you know, that summer when I graduated college wound up being like the craziest summer of my life looking back on it, because a month later we had wound up booking a residency. You know, we had someone managing us. We didn't have, you know, a booking agent or a lawyer or anything like that. And so the label actually booked us a string of shows during the month of August at Pianos in New York City. Which is like a small 120 cap dive bar. I grew up in New Jersey, and so my parents would come to see us every Wednesday there. And you know, it was like the first time the band played in New York. That first show, it was like, you know, decently packed, like 50-60 people, and like we probably knew most of them. And you know, my parents were like, oh, this is cute, you know, like that's great. Yeah, like, yeah, we've been to your shows. But it was like really those subsequent performances where like all these shows were selling out, and we realized that a lot of the people who were coming were now like people from other record labels and, you know, booking agents and all these people in the industry. And so you know, my parents were really supportive in that and been like, okay, if you're gonna do it, like this probably seems like the surest thing of them all, and so like, you know, we'll figure it out. And so yeah, I wound up playing in the band for what, 8 years or so. And you know, in that time we had what was it, two or three, I don't even remember anymore, two or three full-length records. You know, our records were charting on Billboard, which was awesome. You know, got to play SNL and all the late night shows, every music festival imaginable. You know, I didn't even have a passport when I started playing in the band. Like, I had never left the country. I think the only really big trip I took as a child was going to Florida to go to Disney. Like, I had never, yeah, I had never really left. And so going from a point of like not having a passport to then, you know, I having to like get a second passport because I got additional pages in my passport and then like they got filled and like I really wow. traveled a lot and was really, yeah, strong flex. Was really happy about that. And then, you know, the kind of my, the thing for me that was really special, you know, I vividly remember when we first met with our booking agent, Ryan Craven, who, you know, now he books Lord and War on Drugs, and Purity Ring and a few other bands. He actually just, he was at Paradigm and just started his own agency, TBA. But I vividly remember, like, we were, for anyone from Boston or familiar with Boston, we were eating falafel at the Middle East. You know, there's like a restaurant, and then there's a like 100 cap room upstairs, and then downstairs there's a larger venue in there. And you know, he's like, what do you guys like, what do you want to do, like, you know, when you think about like where you want the band to be, like what are some things that you want to do? And I was like, you know, I'd like just met the guy and we're like talking about like jazz records, and you know, here's me with like the hubris of being the only one in the band who's like taking music business classes, where I'm like, what percentage are you gonna take, you know, like
trying to sound smart.
Yeah, trying to sound smart.
That is us.
Trying to sound smart. And like, I knew so little, and that was even more than the other guys in the band knew. And you know, I was like, look, I grew up in New Jersey. If we ever play Madison Square Garden, like I quit, like I'm just gonna quit, because I don't really think anything bigger would happen for me, you know, like that's all I would really need. And so I think it's fitting that, you know, like 7.5 years later in 2013, we sold out Madison Square Garden, and, you know, like my parents came and they rented like a bus, like they chartered a bus up there with like all of my family and their friends. They even had like their own, like green room backstage, cause there were so many of them that like we had to set up like their own hospitality area. So that was the cool part of my life. Then everything kind of went downhill after that. No. So, you know,
not completely downhill. We're here at Jexel. Here we are.
So yeah, I mean, thing, and I know like some of this we'll talk about in a little bit, but you know, in the music industry, I don't necessarily think that career trajectory is an upward spike, right? Like mm-hmm. this is not you're not going into a field like, I don't know, banking or design or something where it's like, cool, you graduated, you're starting here, now you're gonna do this next, you know, you're a coordinator, now you're a manager, now you're a senior manager. And like, yeah, sure, some people enjoy that level, but a lot of other people I know, like, it's kind of like this, right? It's like, you're doing well, then you kind of pivot to something else. And so, you know, I was in my 30s, I had never had a real job before. I was like, okay, I want to do something else. Like, you know, I've been gone all the time, where, you know, my girlfriend, now wife, like I want to like some stability. So from there, I wound up transitioning. I worked for a PR and marketing company called Girly Action Media for about a year. And that was like my first formal office job. And it was, I learned a lot. you know, I learned a lot just as far as, you know, how to email someone properly, I would say, and like artist relations. But it was also a really good opportunity to kind of leverage my experience as a musician and kind of the people that I had met. And yeah, then from there, I actually went back to Berkeley and I taught there for about 3 years under a great mentor of mine, Jeff Dornfeld. He was a professor of mine. You know, he taught all the live music industry classes there, and was starting an institute there, basically, like, if you can imagine taking Mad Dragon on tour. He had taken the student-run record label there, and had partnerships with a bunch of music festivals, thanks to Jerry Barrett, who's the COO of Live Nation Global Touring. And so if you ever want to know, like, what power is like, you know, Jerry would send like a 2-sentence email to the booker of, you know, Lollapalooza or Governor's Ball and say, hey, I need a band on this festival. Oh, sure thing, Jerry, whatever you need. Yeah. Never hearing the band, right? And so we kind of created this thing where students were able to perform on all these music festivals. And it was really cool. I was also touring more than I was when I was in a band and getting paid less. So that was interesting as well. And then, you know, what had actually happened was I was still living in New York, but then also living in Boston. And so my wife and I were like now between two different cities. And then an opportunity came up at Drexel, and yeah, that's a very, that'll probably need to be edited. That's a very long-winded explanation of kind of how I wound up at Drexel.
No, but that was a great summary.
Yeah, especially since we're all like in that point of college where it's like the end is so close, but we feel like we just got here and like having like existential crises. Like every other week or maybe every week. I'm just trying
I still have them all the time. I mean, huge Oasis fan, and I was like, you know, I was like, man, what t-shirt should I wear for this podcast? You know, I need to look good for this podcast. And what's funny about this t-shirt is that this was from the last show that Oasis ever played, because we were on tour in Europe and we were playing a festival in France called Rock and Sen. And do you need something? Oh, okay, you're just listening to me. And I remember we played and Oasis was the headliner, and I was like so excited. And like all their gears on stage and like all the amps are on and everything, like everything's ready to go. And you know, someone from the festival comes out and like, you know, they announce it in English first, which I thought was interesting now considering it was a French festival, but they announced it in English first, like Noel and Liam got into a big fight, you know, they stormed off, like they're not playing, you know, like they're done. And I'm like, oh, come on. This is like some real shtick that they're like, you know, playing off the fact that like Oasis fights all the time. And then like they announced it in French and like everyone starts like losing their shit. And like, not like a riot, but like people are getting like really pissed off. And I'm like, oh no, like this is real. Like they're actually like done. And, you know, that was like the end, like that was their last like public get together was at that festival. And I didn't know him at the time, but actually I'd met him through Berkeley, but a friend of mine, John Chakowski, was Oasis's tour accountant. And he actually I remember talking to him and he was telling me his story from that day of basically like being in the production office. I don't remember if it was Noel or Liam, but one of them basically started smashing all of their other guitars and like just smashed like all their stuff backstage and then like got in a car and left. And they were like, wait, what, like, you guys are supposed to go on. And their tour manager was like, no, they're done. And so John had this t-shirt and he gave it to me, and it has the tour date on it and like all of that. So,
wow. That's a, that's a crazy experience. I think like also it's very, I don't want to say comforting at the expense of like, you know, you like not knowing like what you wanted to do, but I feel like a lot of professors and a lot of speakers that we have in, a lot of them kind of have like a similar experience. They, you know, set out to do one thing and they end up doing another thing and then something completely different. So given that your career thus far has been very non-linear and you've been through a lot of different things and you've experienced a lot of different things, how would you measure success? Like, how do you define success? Like, is it in numbers? Is it in experiences?
You know, I think success, and this is like advice that I had gotten early on from someone that I really looked up to in a band. I remember like being at a music festival and, you know, he was like, because I think too, especially from the musician side of things, there's this kind of dichotomy or like false bottom where you like, you might be publicly perceived as being like successful, right? But like inside, you feel like you're still struggling, right? And so I remember like when we were playing on like Letterman and like Kimmel and Fallon and all this stuff, and you know, people from high school coming out of the woodwork being like, oh, I saw you on TV, like that's crazy, like you must be driving, you know, like living it up, like blah blah blah. And I'm like, I'm, you know, I'm still living in like a glorified closet right now, paying like $250 a month in rent because I'm continually terrified that like it's all going to be over, right? And so I think when you're thinking about success, it's not like, it's a moving target in a way, right? And I think that's something that's important for everyone to continually have, is that like, success should be something that's continually reevaluated every like 1, 3, 5 years, right? Because like for me as a musician, success is a lot different than like me in academia as being success. And so I think like the first thing for me was like being able to pay my rent, like as a musician, can I pay my rent without having some sort of other job, right? Can I just make a living from playing music? But I think that also brings up the concept of this whole struggle between art and commerce as well, right? Like on the creative side, you should be happy with just being able to express yourself and be creative. And, you know, that success should almost, you know, not even involving kind of the financial side of things, should really just be about, do you feel like you're improving, right? Like, do you feel like you're expressing yourself? Do you feel like you're bettering yourself with every new song that you write, with every new painting that you make, you know, with every new sculpture, whatever it is? And, you know, I think like as I've gotten older, you know, success for me is really just continually pushing myself, right? Like, and not being, you know, this is a sign that I've been doing too much Peloton, because I started to quote like Peloton instructors in a sense. You know, like you need to be comfortable with the uncomfortable, but like as soon as you get comfortable with that, I think it's also time to move on, right? So I think kind of embracing those opportunities that push you outside of your comfort zone. And, you know, everyone will have a different answer for this, but like for me personally, like when I start to get comfortable, like that's when I get lazy. That's when I feel like I'm underperforming. And so when I look to continually better myself, that's when I'm like, okay, I need to do something different, right? Whether that's like a pivot in my career change, whether that's like, how do I build on top of this? And so, you know, being successful for me right now, especially in the time of like the pandemic, where it's so easy for us just to like kind of slog through our days, is being like, what new thing have I come out of today with, right? Like, what did I accomplish today? Like, was I on my phone doom scrolling all day? Or like, do I feel like I've actually pushed myself a little bit further, right? And I think that's part of the draw. There were two draws for me in academia. One, I fully believe that in some weird way, maybe it's a sadistic way, it's a performance, right? And like, I get nervous still. Like, this is true. I get nervous every time I teach a class, whether it's on Zoom or whether it's in person, that when I'm teaching a class, like I get that same anxiety I get when I would play a show. And I always said, like, with performing, like, if that feeling ever goes away, like, then it's a job and this mm-hmm. isn't fun. And mm-hmm. like, it's time to do something else. And that kind of happened for me. But with teaching, like, I still get that, right? Like, I'm still nervous. I'm still like, you know, looking over like my notes or my prep. And so, you know, for me, that's a really important thing. And that, like, that's really that uncomfortable thing is pushing me to do better. And the other thing too, is that like, I'm always striving to learn, right? And so I really enjoy being in an environment where we're trying to really push that narrative forward. And so, you know, I think for anyone, when you're like in this existential crisis of being like, oh my God, I'm graduating college. Like, what the hell am I gonna do? Like, how am I gonna get there? I think it's really about like looking at those goals of like, you know, where you want to be in 1, 3, and 5 years, and being realistic with that, and figuring out the ways in which, you know, you can get there. And, you know, being okay with like the fact that your first job out of college, like, it's probably not going to be your dream job, right? And that's fine. But using that as an opportunity just to be familiar with whatever, you know, area of the business that you're getting in, with using it to meet other people, and really just expand upon your network. So hopefully, you know, in 5 years, 10 years, everyone's calendar is different, that like you can get to that level that like you want to be in. But I think the hard pill to swallow, and you'll hear a lot of entrepreneurs talk about this early on, is that this whole concept of work-life balance is bullshit, right? Like, early on, it doesn't exist, right? If you really want something, especially in a competitive industry, like, you're gonna have to put in, you know, the extra hours, right? Like, it's not just about what's happening in the office. It's like everything that's also happening outside of it. And so, I think to enjoy success, like, find what it is that you enjoy doing or where it is that you want to go, and bust your ass until you get there, right? And then after you've gotten to that place, like, then you might be able to, you know, ease up on the gas pedal a little bit to try to level your life out. But for a lot of people, you know, their work and life are kind of mixed in with one another. And I know I shouldn't be celebrating that, especially at a time when so many people are feeling burnout, but, you know, it just, you know, another Peloton reference for you, or just like racing. Now that I've told you that I used to be a spandex clad bicycle racer, it's that same mentality of always, that competitive mentality of always feeling like someone's behind you, right? And so it's like, someone is always there, you know, training as hard as you, putting in those hours. And so you just really need to be self-motivated to push through that.
Yeah, for sure. Lots of advice. I'm going to have to re-listen to this back. So whenever I need it.
I forgot what I said anymore.
So you'll rewatch it too.
Yeah.
So obviously, I think we could all agree, no matter how we define success between me, you, Regina, whoever, we could say that your career thus far has definitely been one of success. I mean, I know even my friends from home have always like listened to you and like, I was like, oh yeah, by the way, that's my professor in that song. It's like, so obviously like, even just like for me, Regina's, the people of me and Regina's age compared to like people 5 years younger than us and 5 years older than us, trends are going to be so different. And like, even just like that amount of time is a lot for how trends work. So obviously how the industry has changed from when you were coming out of college from for us now is like completely different in the age of social media, and like people are going viral overnight on TikTok and like becoming millionaires in a year, you know what I mean? So how, what, like coming from someone who's been in the industry longer than we have, so what was your perspective on like the changes in the industry from your time graduating college to now?
Yeah, I mean, it's really interesting because when I graduated college, you know, one of the main movers was, you know, and this is like 2007, 2008, it was all about blogs, right? And so it was all about like someone who had a highly regarded opinion, you know, basically saying that like this band was cool, right? And that like this band was like someone you should look out for. And so, you know, Pitchfork for me was like, do you guys know what Pitchfork is anymore? I don't remember.
Yes.
You know, Pitchfork was like the holy grail. And if, you know, they could really, they really had this influence of making or breaking a band. And so that, you know, and then coupled that with like these higher profile showcase opportunities like South by Southwest, where it was like really about getting out there and, you know, being a, you know, being presented like on the stage of the Rolling Stone showcase or like the Spin showcase, and, you know, like basically having this pedestal to be on. And so now, you know, now you look at this place, especially, you know, I think further driven by the pandemic, where, you know, obviously musicians aren't touring right now. They're like looking at all these different platforms of, you know, live streams and whatnot. And, you know, it's really interesting, you know, especially looking at platforms, you know, like TikTok, you know, looking at these new like community building platforms like Clubhouse, where you have artist appeal really being driven by algorithms, right? And so it's, you know, and especially, you know, I'm not on TikTok because like I have enough problems with like my own social media demons that I already have, that like I'm already too addicted to social media. I know that. But, you know, the algorithm of TikTok is so strong to really to serve people, you know, what they want to be served before they even really know that they want it. And so I think, you know, that's going to be, we're going to see that even paralleled in other industries. Like I, seeing how the pandemic has changed a lot of like grocery delivery, you know, I'm waiting for the day in which like, we're, you know, you get sent groceries before you even know that you want them. Right. And then you also get like another box to send back the groceries that you don't want. But you know, what I find really interesting about right now, especially in this shift in kind of how the industry is changing and kind of how the younger generation and the, you know, are kind of driving this cultural change, is that, you know, there was a report out the other day that, you know, the major label global consumption on Spotify is starting to dip, right? And it was like a few years ago, it was like upper 80%, like close to 90% global consumption. And in 2020, it had dipped down to like, I think 75% of the consumption on Spotify was for made up of major labels. And, you know, they were basically arguing that by 2030, like major labels could essentially lose, you know, they could be under half of the global listenership as these younger generations are looking to new platforms like TikTok, like, you know, the buzzword used to be Bitcoin and crypto, and now that's kind of transitioned into NFTs, mm-hmm. which, you know, now you have all these artists releasing music on, you know, on NFTs, mm-hmm. people trading, you know, adults trading cards on, like, I don't understand the whole like sport card thing. Yeah. That's like you don't really own it.
I think someone said, because someone talked about that in my communications class and said like someone sold a video of LeBron James dunking for $208,000. I was like, excuse me, I could do that. Maybe on a little tykes, but I could do that.
Yeah. And so, you know, like, it was like Kings of Leon announced yesterday that they're doing their album on an NFT. And so, you know, what I really am excited for, like, especially growing up being like sort of a punk rock kid, is I enjoy, you know, some of the disruption that happens, right? Like, I enjoy seeing the opportunity that some people might be able to kind of grab onto and take advantage of outside of that major label system. And so it's really interesting to see how, you know, how the discovery process is working mm-hmm. for younger generations, right? Again, for me, it was like signing on to like Brooklyn Vegan or Pitchfork or like Stereo Gum. And it was like, that's where I was finding out about music. Mm-hmm. And now you're getting people who are looking, you know, TikTok is serving up all of these recommendations and, you know, kind of creating to some extent a pipeline for a lot of major labels to really like scoop up younger artists. You're having like, you know, TikTok producers that are like out there to produce your next 15-second song to hopefully drive you out there. But what I think is also interesting is that like it's not always a guaranteed measure, right? So like, mm-hmm. even when you look at, you know, 2020 was the first year where TikTok shared all of its data, right, on like all of their artists. And so, you know, like you have your Drakes of the world, right, who are like already big artists, and they can take the platform of TikTok and like push themselves even further. And, you know, at the same time, you also have like Megan Thee Stallion, who like was another superstar of TikTok, but it didn't translate into like a ton of album sales for her, right? Like, I think she sold, you know, there was like 100,000 unit streams, whatever you want to call them. But like, she wasn't the big, you know, she didn't sell, one of her label mates even sold more records for her, right? So I look at this as being, you know, when YouTube started, everyone was like, I just need to record a cover song and make it cool. And then like a major label is going to find me. Right. Mm-hmm. I think a lot of people have kind of gone into TikTok, and I've heard a lot of people getting some success out of TikTok from that. I think it's just about where the longevity is, right? Like, yeah. is there, you know, when you think about the whole foundation of major labels, you know, traditionally betting on a few artists, knowing that only one or two is going to pan out, like, how does that translate into like what they're finding out of TikTok? And so, you know, I think at the very least, what it does do is further remove some of those boundaries, you know, level the playing field to some extent, that like everyone has the ability to create now. Everyone has the ability to distribute their own music. You know, everyone has the ability of putting their stuff out there. And so, yeah, it's just another way of, you know, another thing that younger artists kind of need to have in their toolbox, I would say, of marketing essentials.
Yeah, I totally agree. Like, the longevity is so unpredictable of what's happening right now, but there's no doubt, like, in this moment, the power of Gen Z is, like, insane. I don't even know if I'm part of Gen Z, so I'm not going to say that I am.
We're called
Zennials, I think it is.
Zillennials,
something like that.
I don't even know. I think we're the older siblings of Gen Z.
Yeah, I agree.
Are you guys both on TikTok?
Regina's famous. I make stuff only like for my friends.
I wouldn't say I'm TikTok famous. Char's hyping me up.
Out of my
friends,
I would say like Regina's one of the most like famous TikTokers I know.
It's
like how many listeners do you or like
listeners?
I don't know. How many views?
Yeah.
What's your interaction like with your community on TikTok?
I get a good amount of views per video.
That's not.
I don't want to sound like I'm bragging. Like,
we need to quantify. Like, quantify.
I can say it for you.
She's like in the thousands, like tens of thousands. I don't even know.
I get a couple thousand views per video. Depending.
And I think you've gone viral a few times, like a couple hundreds of thousands as well. Sometimes.
Yeah. Like, there's some. I have a couple videos where, like, on the view thing, there's a K. Like, you know, however many K. But
so have you found like I'm flipping the script now. Have you found
I'm being interviewed now.
Yeah, like a narrative that you were like experimenting with. And you're like, oh, this is what kind of takes off, or is this more organic? Like, what's the, again, as someone who's not on TikTok, so I'm not gonna go look up your videos, like what has been what are your videos, and like, is there something that you feel like you can pinpoint as to like why they've gotten popular?
Yeah, I mean, definitely, like, you're not wrong in like saying subjects, because there's different topics and different things that people are interested in. It's really easy to find community within TikTok. I was over at Char's house the other day. We have a weekly bachelor thing that we do. And I was talking with her roommate. We were talking about the beginning of TikTok and how things are a lot more simpler, definitely even before COVID, and how most of the things on TikTok were just like dance videos and just like some people, you know, just, you know, filming like, oh, here's what I did in the day. And once COVID started and people started flocking to TikTok, there's a lot of corners and different spaces within TikTok that have different communities. There's people who like filmmaking, there's fashion, there's music, there's communities for all people of all different, you know, races, sexualities, gender identities and stuff. And yeah, like personally, that's what I kind of talk about, just about like being queer and being a part of the LGBTQ+ community. Because like growing up, that's not something that I had. And there's so many young people, so many young, like, people in high school, middle school who are on TikTok, that's the main demographic. And so it's just a really amazing space for people to kind of find people who they can relate to and not feel so lost and lonely. I mentioned this with one of my roommates. In the beginning of TikTok, like, there's a thing that people do now. They caption their videos when you're talking. People will type it out and you can edit it so people can read what you're saying, because in the beginning people didn't really do that. And there is a, like, there's a deaf community and the hard of hearing community who are on TikTok, and there will be people commenting, hey, can you caption your videos? And that's a very common thing for people to do now. And I think that's really cool that people like all want to just make everything just really inclusive for everyone. That was very long-winded, but
no, I mean, like, again, I feel like I know TikTok on such like a broad surface level, right, as like not being a user, and again, like, of that broad perspective, like mostly just being like on the music side of it. And so you know, hearing, I mean, you even just said this, but it's like you have this platform that seems like it's promoting inclusivity, right? Like, which is amazing. And you know, it sounds, you essentially have a giant culture of subsects of more or less counterculture. So it's like you have all of these different niche things, and areas in which people might not have been able to express themselves or feel comfortable expressing themselves, like, you know, especially in a place where it's like, if you come from a small town, like, you might not know anyone like you, right? Like, and, you know, even making this cross-generational, like, I think that's what college used to be, right? It was like when,
for sure,
like, for me, it was like, I didn't know anyone really like me in middle school or high school, or just didn't really, you know, it's like, you know, I'm still friends. I still have a core group of friends that, like, I grew up with, but, like, a lot of times our friends that we grow up with, it's just because they, like, live down the street from us, or, mm-hmm. you know, like, we went to school together, and as you grow up, like, your ideologies and, you know, your worldviews start mm-hmm. to change. And you're not really similar, but then, like, you go to, you know, an environment like where, you know, you're studying something that you want to study with hopefully like-minded people. And mm-hmm. this is wildly off topic what we're supposed to be talking about, but, I just think it's really cool to see that there's a platform to kind of expedite that in a way for making people feel welcome and making people feel like they can, you know, have those conversations and find those people when they might live somewhere far away from any of that.
For sure. So let's backtrack a little bit, because we're talking about TikTok and music. And so we want to touch on how TikTok has, like, impacted the Grammy nominations, because the Grammys are coming up. And I looked at the lineup, or the nominations for the big four categories, and a lot of them are, you know, yep. artists and songs very popular on TikTok. So my question for you is, do you believe that the value of the Grammys has devalued over the years? Do you feel that it's a legitimate representation of, you know, what's successful in the music industry?
I mean, I think this is like a very
yeah. I agree.
I feel like people have very different opinions, so I feel like whatever. I apologize. My window's right there. Okay. I feel like whatever you say, someone is gonna feel strongly one way or the other.
Yeah, I mean, I think, like, looking at what the Grammys are now, you also need to, like, think about what the Grammys, like, represent as a whole, or, like, historically, like, why the Grammys even came to existence, right? Mm-hmm. And so it's like, this was always, you know, winning a Grammy was about free promotion, right? It was started by record labels to celebrate artists that are primarily signed to record labels, right? Like, by and large. Mm-hmm. And, you know, I think what's even more interesting, and you know, when you look at, like, the history of, like, even NARA starting, you know, originally it was just supposed to be something where an organization, LA, wanted a star on the Walk of Fame, as they were trying to, like, you know, what was the, it was the Hollywood Beautification Committee, that's what it was. They asked the record labels in the 50s to nominate one artist that they could put, like, a star on the Walk of Fame, right? And of course, you know, like, Decca and Columbia and whoever else at that time, like, they couldn't agree on one artist, right? Like, mm-hmm. no one could agree. So they start, you know, the Grammy, they start NARIS, which is, you know, the body that just kind of informs the Grammys. And, you know, all this is supposed to be built on the fact that, like, they don't want the nominees, like, aren't supposed to be tied to, like, the album charts, right? They're not supposed to be tied to sales. And so, you know, and it's also supposed to be voting from people that are creatives and musicians, right? They don't want people who are, you know, publicists or promoters, whatever. And so, you know, historically, there's just always been, you know, like, we see The Weeknd right now, right? Like, tweeting about, like, how he's been snubbed. But this has been going on, like, since the beginning of the Grammys, right? Like, when mm-hmm. rock and roll was first starting, the people in the Grammys were like, oh, no, this is amateur music. You know, we don't want to celebrate the Grammys. Like, it's all about jazz, right? It's all about, Billie Holiday and Ella Fitzgerald, right? The same thing could have been said for hip hop, right? Like for the longest time, like hip hop wasn't, you know, it was really clashing with people acceptance into the Grammys. And so, you know, I think, and of course there's like tons without even going into like all of the allegations and whatnot about like the crap that has been going on internally, like in Neris. You know, I think you just, you have all this going on. And so, you know, I don't necessarily, like, maybe just because I never won a Grammy. So it's like, I got like, I'm salty about it.
You were snubbed.
I know, I was snubbed. But like, yeah, without a doubt, TikTok is changing, as we were saying before, right? Like the cultural influence, like, of our society, right? This platform is driving trends. Record labels are signing people born out of it. Mm-hmm. And, you know, I personally, it's an award show to celebrate people to hopefully drive sales. And so kind of how, what I was saying before, like as we were seeing this influence being pulled away from major labels, you know, through like the DSPs, as we have more of these alternatives to access to music, I think that's going to start to pull away from this drive of what the Grammys are, right? If younger and younger generations are consuming their music elsewhere, they're not going to care about the Grammys, yeah. Right? Like, you know, and viewership has been going down historically over years. And it's, again, it's been used as that platform to uplift and have albums sold. It's also used as this other, you know, promotional outlet to like, oh, a big artist is going on tour. Or it has a new album coming out. We're going to have them perform on the Grammys, right? So it's mm-hmm. like this big commercial thing. And you know, I like the upsets, right? It's like I like when the underdog wins. And so even like who any of the artists that like I want to win probably aren't the ones that will win. But I mean, like, what's your guys' take on it? Like you're on this younger generation, this blended generation, like you're saying. Like, do you guys watch the Grammys? I think it's also, you both kind of represent a niche in the grand scheme of things because you're music industry yeah. students. You're not kind of part of the general public, mm-hmm. but like, how do you guys view it?
Yeah,
I feel like it's kind of like when you grow up and you think that like Santa's real. Like you grow up and thinking
Santa is real. Stop it.
I'm sorry. Santa is real. Yeah, I'm so sorry. don't let her watch us until she's older. But I feel like growing up, like the thought of the Grammys is like this big thing, and everyone's like, "Oh, the Grammys is like that's like the highest award you can get." And for some people, maybe it is. But I think I think it's becoming less and less relevant, and just like kind of learning how the industry works and learning who's behind all of the behind the scenes that goes into award shows like this. It's just, it feels like a narcissistic pat on the back, like by the labels. It's like who's on the voting committee? Like who are these people? Like where are they coming
like
from? Who do they know? Yeah. So I feel like, I think you're right in saying that like, a lot of the younger generations, probably starting with ours, it's mm-hmm. going to become less and less relevant, and people aren't really going to care, and they're going to say, well, this person has this many followers on TikTok or social media or whatever.
Yeah, but, I totally agree with what both of you guys are saying. Like, as time goes on, it's just, like, less and less important, not important, less important, because obviously, a music industry student, we're going to be watching the Grammys. We have to know what's going on because it's just like how our nature is. And just like, it's like different for everyone else. Cause I don't think any of my friends from home who are like nursing majors watch it or something. You know what I mean? It's becoming less and less relevant as time goes on. And I think how people are measuring it, you know, when it first started versus how people measure it now is two completely different like ends of the spectrum. And you know, I don't know what happens, what goes on in the Grammys. Who knows who's doing what, but I don't know. I feel like no matter who knows what or who knows who, like, it's not going to matter in like a couple years from now.
Yeah. And I mean, you know, who was, it was Deborah Dugan, who was, she was the former CEO of the Recording Academy. Right. And like in her allegations against the committee, you know, these are like some of the things that she brought up, right? Just that, like, you know, people who are committee members have relationships, you know, with artists that they've nominated and put on the ballot, or that, like, artists who aren't even on the ballot, you know, people can nominate them even if they didn't make the long list. And so, as you're saying, like, we don't know who's in the inner circle. It's like purposely opaque, and it leads to a lot of, you know, these discrepancies of people being like, well, why didn't this artist win, right? Like, again, but it's the same thing going back to the 50s, right? Like, or, you know, even later when it's like Lionel Richie beat out Prince and everyone's like, what the hell are you talking, like, this Prince record was huge, like, how did this happen? There's always been kind of this loss in translation between, like, artists that are like on top of the charts that just like might represent a genre that, you know, doesn't, you know, coalesce with the people that are on the board. And perhaps, you know, kind of going back to what we were saying before, maybe the strategy to, you know, bring the younger culture into it is having part of the TikTok generation, you know, being nominated for awards, right?
Yeah, there are a few that are nominated right now. Megan Thee Stallion is up for nomination.
Let's do some predictions. Do you know off the top of your head who's like nominated? I got a list.
I did my homework, so I went down and like picked, you know, my favorite, not necessarily like who, this is not like, you know, me betting on like who I think is going to win. It's like betting on like my favorite for the year. So, all right.
Yeah, for record of the year, half of them are songs that were very, very big on TikTok. There's Rockstar, Say So, Don't Start Now, Savage. Like, those are very, very large. So it's half of that category.
Yeah. I mean, you know, for record of the year, I'm kind of torn between Savage and Don't Start Now. I think Savage is a track.
I agree.
It's really good. You know, I have not necessarily vested, but I know a lot of people on Dua Lipa's team, from like her MD to her promoter who promotes for Live Nation, who promotes her tours. And so I want that win for them. But like, you know, personally, I dig Savage as a tune for sure.
Yeah, that's a great one.
All right, what's next?
I think we got album of the year. Yeah, I think I have my prediction just because Taylor Swift's army is wild. We all know that.
Oh, I'm so scared of Taylor Swift stans.
Never
get into a fight with them on Twitter. It'll not end well for you.
Like, I'm a huge like One Direction stan. Maybe that dates me, I don't know. And a huge like Marvel stan. Two completely different worlds, but I would never step foot near Taylor Swift fan. Like, I don't want to like know what would happen.
Taylor is all about her re-recordings right now of all of her old albums, you know?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Yeah.
It's Which, like, thing. You know, good for her, because that whole situation was a whole situation for no reason. And like, you know, obviously there's a lot of things that weren't completely transparent, especially like, if you're just a fan and you don't know anything about the music industry and how contracts work when you're 13 and then how contracts work when you're 18, I don't want to get into it, but like there's a lot of things that weren't completely transparent.
Future lawyer.
Stop it. So it was just like a whole thing. So like, I'm happy for her that she gets to re-record it just so that whole situation is.
Yeah. I feel like everyone's going to expect Taylor to win, because I think that's like the obvious choice. Mm-hmm. But I feel like something's going to come out of left field with this one. I feel like it's going to be like Coldplay or something. Because that's like, that's usually what happens, you know?
Yeah.
I hate Coldplay.
I love Coldplay. Oh, I mean, so I get emotional to Coldplay. But, you know, for like Drexel, I want Taylor to win because an alum, Jonathan Lowe, produced an engineer, was a producer and engineer on the record.
Oh, flex.
Not know that.
So, yeah, Jonathan Lowe. My indie heart, my like early 2000s blog heart really wants Haim to win, especially mm-hmm. because Rostam from Vampire Weekend, you know, was a part of that project, as well as Ariel Reichschild. I never say his last name right, but yeah, that's, you know, I have a strong feeling Taylor's got some strong pull, and like I said, the bringing in the Drexel alum situation, I really like that win, but I was pretty hype on that Haim record. I wanted to hate it so bad, but I really liked it.
All right, let's move on to Song of the Year.
Yeah. Sorry. I have no clue. No, it's okay. But this category, absolutely no clue. Lots of viral hits on here, so.
Yeah, there's a lot that are on Song of the Year that are also nominated for Record of the Year.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I kind of get down with the box. I've been down with that song. My short list of that is Cardigan, Don't Start Now in the Box. That's kind of where yeah. I'm at. I can't make a definitive pick. And again, some of that is like, what do I think is going to win versus like, what do I like?
Yeah.
Yeah, no, hard I think to definitely say, those.
Yeah, I love Billy, so obviously I want her to win. She's had obviously a lot of Grammy success in the past, so maybe she doesn't need it right now, but I want her to win. But will she win? I don't really know. I feel like
I think
she's not even in my top three for this category. No shame.
I agree. Definitely last year, I think her wins were like last year was her year for sure. But I think like, she had like five of them. Everyone was so mad, but it was well deserved in my opinion.
Her and Phineas, like I don't want to hear it.
But yeah, this year definitely, I think it's going to be one of the TikTok songs.
They got it.
Our last category is Best New Artist, and there's some good ones on here.
This is like my indie heart, and you know I'm going with. Uplifting women and a killer SNL performance and going Phoebe Bridgers.
Me too.
I have to agree with you. It's gotta be. It's
I don't know if
be.
She's gonna win, but I really
We're rooting
want
for
her
too.
Yeah.
Again, yeah, this is another one of those picks for me where I'm like, I don't know if she's gonna win, but like the record is awesome. You know, just so many grumpy old men like coming at her for like her performance where I'm like, no, like that was fucking awesome. Mm-hmm. And like that's that, like come on.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, totally.
That's my pick.
Yeah, I think
my
we're
pick as well.
She's got
her over here.
Yeah, I wish the best for her. So let's wrap this up with just what are you listening to right now? Like what are some of your favorite artists? What do you like, albums, projects, anything?
So I mean, you gotta remember, right? Like I have a 1-year-old now. Mm-hmm. And she's super into music. Like she's like super into music and just like sits there and like bobs her head back and forth, and like she's really into like old reggae, which is strange. I don't know, like how
so funny
taste.
Like
she's
how
got
we
an
got
old
there.
Soul.
Yeah, like she's super into like dance hall and like rock steady and like English beat, and so you know, nothing like groundbreaking, but like we've been listening to a lot of Madness over here, a lot of The Specials, a lot of Desmond Baker, and then, you know, like me personally, like I said, I was playing a lot of Phoebe Bridgers for her the other day, like trying to like get her into it. You know, for me, my musical taste kind of like stopped developing, I feel like past my 20s, and so I go back to a lot of things that like I've listened to when I was younger, maybe from a place of nostalgia, maybe from just like decision fatigue all the time.
Oh, yeah.
Of like, what do I want to listen to? I mean, I'm someone who remembers when before Spotify had all of the suggestions of like when it was just a streaming platform mm-hmm. of like going on and being like, what do I want to listen to? There's just too much stuff out here. Like, I don't know what I actually want to listen to.
Yeah, totally agree.
So I appreciate, you know, as far off as they can be, I do appreciate a lot of, you know, the recommendations. All right.
The daily mixes.
Yeah. My most recent listen to artists have been, let's see, Bjork, Phoebe Bridgers, Spiritualized, The Field. So I sometimes just like really long, weird instrumental music, Volpex, Spoon, for any like hardcore Volpex. Kids, Lifetime, Brian Eno. Why was I listening to The Killers? I don't know, but I was listening to The Killers recently.
Daughter's a Killers fan.
What's that?
I was gonna say maybe your daughter's a Killers fan.
Yeah. Oh, you know, I think I was watching the Song Exploder episode on Netflix of The Killers, which you guys have seen that, right? Song Exploder?
Personally,
I haven't, no.
How are you, like,
I'll do it right after. Okay, don't
oh
judge
my
me.
God. All right.
It's pandemic, like life is everywhere.
So it started off as like an audio only podcast. Where like the way that the show is edited, the interviewer removes all of his audio, and so like you only hear the artist talking, but it's like pretty much all about songwriting. And so like the artist will pretty much go through from like conception of like, this was just a note like on my phone of me like humming into my phone, into like the whole thing. And like they've had everyone from like Alicia Keys, Lin-Manuel Miranda talking about like Hamilton, REM, like Vampire Weekend, Ty Dolla Sign. And so it's just a really cool show that kind of like breaks all of that down, and The Killers were on there talking about that. So
I think we'll definitely that's where, add that to the list.
Yes. Yeah, you should definitely, definitely check that one out. Look, Coldplay, Fix You, that was in there.
Great song.
Classic at this point.
That is a good song. You know, like whenever anyone is like asking me, they're like, you know, are you still like playing music? Like, what are you doing? And I'm like, my music creation right now is limited to whatever songs I can play on guitar and sing to my daughter. That's kind of like where we're at right now in this time zone.
Mm-hmm. I love that. All right, so we are coming up on time. So
yeah, you guys got class.
We do.
I got places to be.
So thank you, Jeff, so much for coming on this podcast and talking with us. Thank you so much, everyone, for listening. And this is Irresistible.